All right, so some of our discussion of Christian nationalism has veered in and out of discussions about Doug Wilson, and he is a Presbyterian pastor in a relatively small town of Moscow, Idaho. Moscow is on the edge of Washington State, and I think it's close to the University of the Washington State University, and also I guess the University of Idaho is there. So it's a kind of a college town, but they have this church there that's been, sort of influential nationally and internationally for a number of years in the homeschool world. So if you are a homeschooler or have gone to any homeschool conventions, you may know the name Doug Wilson just from that avenue. They publish a curriculum for homeschoolers. And he's written on issues of marriage and gender, really a whole host of issues he's published on, pretty much in the Presbyterian vein. And so he's not a new guy on the scene at all. In fact, he's 70 years old, Doug Wilson is. But he has found himself at the forefront of this discussion of Christian nationalism, partly because he published a book called Mere Christendom that addresses this, and partly because he has been outspoken on these issues long before it ever became a thing, because of his eschatology. He is a pronounced post-millennialist, and proudly so, and promotes that very much. But on top of all that, he has a certain persona that has given him greater visibility and prominence, particularly in the new information age. So, as social media has become a thing, as YouTube has become more widely spread, as, people have, I would even say, learned to do better production at home, they have embraced this and use the new media very, very well. Their church does, and their whole outfit organization, and Doug Wilson himself is a really good writer and very clever guy, but at the same time he is also very edgy, very sarcastic, very provocative, and funny, and those things draw attention and they attract people. So there are reasons why this guy is kind of at the spotlight, but in the midst of all that, there have been a number of people who have an uneasy feeling about Doug Wilson for a number of years, and I appreciated Kevin D. Young, who's a fellow Presbyterian, writing this critique in November and kind of putting a lot of things into print that I think have bothered a lot of people through the years, and particularly because he's critiquing from within the camp. He's a fellow Presbyterian. So that's what I wanted to spend some time talking about today, because I don't think it's unrelated to this whole conversation of Christian nationalism. As we've been saying over and over again, one of the things that's driving this discussion is the sense of frustration that people are having with the world around them, and the desire to want to do something about it, not just to stand by and watch their country go downhill and all the institutions that they love go downhill. So there's a desire to want to take action. And Doug Wilson is a take action kind of a guy. That's his thing. And many of his videos, he talks about helping you, I can't remember the exact terminology, but something like apocalypse proof your family. Like prepare your family for the apocalypse. That's his terminology. And he does things, a lot of things that involve flames and fire. He loves flamethrowers, Molotov cocktails, things that explode, those kinds of things frequently make it into his videos, particularly what he calls No Quarter November, where he sarcastically sort of pokes fun at I guess you might say himself, for being the mild-mannered guy that he is. But in November, he takes off the gloves, which is ironic, because people would say he'd never put them on to begin with. But he does this in November, and you can go back and look at his YouTube. And they are funny. I mean, they're humorous, and I understand what the attraction and what the appeal there is. But he's, you know, he's burning things down with his flamethrower and, you know, throwing bombs and things like that as he's talking about cultural issues. So this is Doug Wilson, and he's gaining quite a following. But there are some things I want to talk about when it comes to Doug Wilson that I think you and I should be aware of and should be concerned about. You know, a lot of people credit Doug Wilson with being bold and unafraid to take on unpopular positions, and I think that's good and right. But his style of doing it is sometimes, I believe, not giving the best testimony. Or another way to say that is he is known for confronting issues of the world head on, but sometimes doing it in a way that is worldly. Now, this is a big topic of discussion for Doug Wilson himself, because he has been accused of this, of appealing to things that are worldly within people. And Doug Wilson takes issue with that because he says, what is worldliness? What is world? Maybe I'll just ask you guys if y'all want to throw out some proposed answers. See who matches up Doug Wilson and who doesn't. I'm going to out the Doug Wilson people here. What is worldliness? Okay, that's good. So we might say the valuing the things the world values. That would be one way of saying it, I think. Probably a really good way of saying it. Anybody got anything to add to that? John? Okay. I think those are two really good approaches. Doug Wilson would say that worldliness is doing things for the applause of the world. That's the way he defines it. And so for him, since he is virtually never applauded by the world, nothing he does can be worldly. I mean, it's just diametrically opposed to the world, he says. In fact, the world hates him, and that is the reason why you can't really call what he does worldly. But think about that for a minute. Because the world hates him, therefore he cannot be worldly. The assumption behind that statement is that if the world hates you, then you are not worldly. So I guess that means that the rest of the world all love each other because they're all worldly, right? No, of course not. We know people in the world hate each other all the time. I mean, the fact that they hate each other is not a sign that one is worldly and one is not. Hatred is a part of the world. And so the fact that he's generating hate from other people is no sign that he is not being worldly. He might just be stirring up people with the kind of animosity and anger with which they stir one another up. I mean, we're talking about this war in Ukraine all the time, right? You got two nations, two peoples at each other's throat and, you know, shooting missiles and bombs and guns at one another. None of them are doing it for Christ. I mean, this has nothing to do with the gospel, but there's a lot of hate, a lot of bloodshed, you know, a lot of animosity there. And you could just multiply that time and time over. Even within our own nation, think about different issues and different factions that are on either side of different issues. Think about the jealousies. Just think about within the world of whether it's hip-hop culture or whether it's movie actors, the kind of jealousies and ambition that divide those people, media personalities, sports personalities. There's just so many areas. CEOs, you know, that just despise one another. Elon Musk can't stand Mark Zuckerberg. Zuckerberg can't stand him. Has nothing to do with whether one of them is godly or not. They just don't like each other. And they have a lot of anger towards one another. So none of that is a sign of your worldliness. I think, you know, what Chris was getting at and John was echoing there, it has more to do with what you're valuing than it is whether or not the world hates you or not. In fact, the world may very well hate you for legitimate reasons. Peter acknowledges this over in 1 Peter chapter 2, whenever he is talking about our life in the world. He wants us to recognize our position as pilgrims in 1 Peter 2. He says, "Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation." He goes on later on to say about our overall life, don't use your freedoms that you have as a cover up for evil. In verse 15, "This is the will of God, that by doing good you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. Honor the emperor." Now, when you hear those kinds of things, you have a sense that Peter is calling us to a standard, not just in our life and conduct, but even in our public discourse. There ought to be something honorable about our public discourse. And he's recognizing that there's a possibility for us to use our Christian freedoms, or to use even our status as Christians, in an ill effect when it comes to the Gentiles. We can conduct ourselves in a dishonorable way before the watching world. It's even one of the requirements of an elder in 1 Timothy chapter 3. One of the requirements of an elder is that he have a good reputation with those who are outside. Now, Paul's obviously not talking about, seeking the applause of people. He says in Galatians chapter 3 that that's not what his motivation is. And here he's obviously not talking about pleasing them with the belief system that we have, but he's just talking about as a general rule that your life is lived in a respectable way, having a good reputation. I'm trying to find this. Yeah, well thought of in verse 7. He must be well thought of by outsiders so that he may not fall into disgrace. We could add to that other passages from Ephesians chapter 5 and places like that that talk about our conduct. Colossians chapter 4. Our conduct toward outsiders, that is towards unbelievers, ought to be lived out in a certain way. And this is what I think is a concern of mine, and Kevin DeYoung does a good job of holding this up, is that some of Doug Wilson's approach, while it might be promoting genuinely Christian positions, it's doing it in a dishonorable, or we might even say in a worldly way. In fact, I think it's hard to distinguish what he does between sort of the shock jocks that were known on radio. I don't know. I don't listen to radio. Does anyone listen to radio anymore? Is there such a thing as a shock jock? I guess they've all moved to social media. But these people who attracted a following just by saying the most shocking things. There's nothing particularly Christian about that. The media personalities have been doing that for a while. So this is sort of at the forefront of the concerns for Doug Wilson, is he just frames things in these kinds of incendiary terms. And Kevin DeYoung says here in his blog post, my My bigger concern is with the long-term spiritual effects of admiring and imitating this Moscow mood. The mood that attracts people to Moscow is too often incompatible with Christian virtue, inconsiderate of other Christians, and ultimately inconsistent with the stated aims of Doug Wilson's Christendom project. In other words, he's saying Doug Wilson has written this book on mere Christendom that wants to spread Christian ideals across the entire nation, and yet the very thing he's doing is undermining that. It's not training people to be Christian. It's training them to be worldly in the way that they conduct themselves, in the way they speak about different things and to different things. He even talks about this tendency of people to move to Moscow. It actually has been a massive pilgrimage. I don't know what the percentages are. The church itself, my understanding, is quite large for that small town, maybe 2,000 people. But it seems like the vast majority of them have not come from the local community by just converting people. They have largely imported from all across the nation people who are flocking to Moscow because they want to live in this sort of environment. Not necessarily on a compound, but in that environment under that church. In fact, I noticed on their website that among the information pieces you can get about the church, there's actually a letter to people who are considering moving to Moscow, because this happens so often. People just up and show up, and they have a letter written by the session, which is the Presbyterian word for elders. The session there has written a letter to people considering a move to Moscow and all the things that they need to have in place before they made a move. For example, a job, you know, just simple things like that. But apparently it's so common, so frequent, they just published an open letter for all those people that are moving there. Well, that's, you know, I'm sure wonderful, you know, for them to reach the promised land like that. But it begs the question about what kind of impact are you making on your community? Like, what kind of evangelistic testimony are you actually having if the people who are there locally are not necessarily joining your church, but you only are attracting the most incendiary firebrands from across the nation and making them a part of your church? So this is, I think a major issue about what is actually being accomplished. Are you actually accomplishing your stated goal of bringing Christendom, the new Christendom into the world the way that you want to? Let's see. I got all these little notes. I can't get to it all, but I have a few more things. I want to talk particularly about the issue of sarcasm, because it is a major component of what Doug Wilson does. Kevin DeYoung says, "The Moscow mood provides a nonstop adversarial stance toward the world and toward other Christians who are deemed or caricatured to be too afraid to tell the truth like it is." So there's just a lot to say about this one, but this is one of the distinctive things about Doug Wilson, is this sarcastic tone. Kevin DeYoung says, he cites a passage from one of these No Quarter November YouTube videos, and he says, "It strikes a tone that's deliberately sarcastic and just a bit naughty. No one really thinks Wilson is timid or cautious for the rest of the year. That's the sarcasm. The naughty part is when Wilson uses words like wuss or wussy, adolescent slang for something weak and effeminate. These are words most Christians don't allow their kids to use, since they're terms that probably originated as a combination of wimp and another word I won't mention," he says. So this is just a little taste of Doug Wilson. But he uses this kind of what we might call locker room talk a lot in what he is saying. And a lot of it comes with a sort of some biting sarcasm. And this is something that Doug Wilson's been criticized for years, and he defends over and over again, saying that there's nothing wrong with sarcasm. And it's true. There is sarcasm in the Bible. God uses sarcasm in the Old Testament whenever he's mocking those who are worshiping idols. He talks about that in Isaiah 44 when he talks about the block of wood. You know, they go out into the forest, they chop down a tree, they fashion it into an idol. With one half of it, they warm themselves in the fire. With the other half, they bow down and worship it. I mean, that's sarcasm. He talks about how these dumb idols can't hear, they can't see, they can't do anything, and yet people are putting their trust in them. When you move into the New Testament, you have sarcasm from the Apostle Paul. Perhaps the most biting sarcasm that you'll find is in 1 Corinthians, where Paul over and over again uses sarcasm. In one particular place in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, there's a number that we could go to, but this is Paul's talking about his own ministry. And he says in verse 8 of 1 Corinthians 4, actually, I'll back up to verse 6. I've applied all these things to myself and Apollos for your benefit, brothers, that you may learn by us not to go beyond what is written, that none of you may be puffed up in favor of one against another. For who sees anything different in you? What do you have that you didn't receive? If you received it, why do you boast as if you didn't receive it? And then he goes and shifts to a sarcastic tone. Already you have all you want. Already you've become rich. Without us, you've become kings. And I would that you did reign, he says, so that we might share the rule with you. For I think that God has exhibited us apostles as last of all, like men sentenced to death, because we've become a spectacle to the world, to angels, and to men. We're fools for Christ's sake, but you're wise. We're weak, but you're strong. We're held in disrepute, but you are held in honor. To the present hour, we hunger and thirst and are poorly dressed and buffeted and homeless. We labor working with our own hands. When reviled, we bless. When persecuted, we endure. When slandered, we entreat. We've become and still are like the scum of the world, the refuse of all things. Paul then says, I do not write these things to make you ashamed, but to admonish you as my beloved children. For though you have countless guides in Christ, you do not have many fathers. For I became your father in Christ Jesus through the gospel. Now, I won't go on and read, but there is more of that kind of language from the Apostle Paul about his love for them. And this is the thing that sets Paul's sarcasm in context. Every time you turn to some sarcastic passage in the Apostle Paul, or for that matter, when you're looking at sarcasm from God in the Old Testament, it is always balanced with affirmations of love and very explicit affirmations of love. In fact, some of the affirmations of love that Paul talks about would probably be mocked by people like Doug Wilson as maybe being too soft or too touchy-feely. Paul has times when he's saying our heart is wide open. We're, you know, completely yours, he says in 2 Corinthians chapter 7. Those kinds of expressions of love are not really found in Doug Wilson. It is pure sarcasm. It's just unending sarcasm. And you don't find, or at least I haven't found in the little bit of listening that I have done to his stuff, I haven't found that balance of expressions of love. It is just sarcasm after sarcasm. And I think this is what Kevin DeYoung is getting at. This sort of deliberate sarcastic and naughty tone that he wants to strike. And as I said, I mean, I I understand the humor of it. People who are around me for any period of time know that I frequently am quoting the Babylon Bee as my primary news source. They are obviously a Christian satire site. But I think the thing about them is that they are decidedly only that. Like, they publish short articles that are poking fun at things in the culture and things sometimes in the church in ways that you know exactly what you're getting. You know what to expect. In other words, they're not claiming to be a church, a pastor, a sort of particular Christian community or any of those things. They are very explicitly what they are. Doug Wilson's different. He's actually claiming not only to be a pastor, but to have an entire church movement and to speak to the church on broad topics and issues. He writes on broad topics and issues. And does so, I would say, without a pastoral tone. He talks about this tendency to take swipes at other Christians, conservative groups, people that... That Kevin DeYoung says would be on the same side on almost all the cultural issues as Doug Wilson. Now, Doug Wilson disputes whether or not these people are actually on the same side with him, but I'm just going to leave that point to the side for the moment. I want to kind of just get to the issue. He uses them for a punchline over and over again. And DeYoung says, if Moscow can watch their opponents get triggered by these sarcasms and jokes poked at them, this they find funny. When serious criticism is leveled at Moscow, the response often includes a smattering of mockery and memes. This isn't Wilson using his famous serrated edge to make a prophetic point against a godless culture. This is intentionally making fun of other Christians for a quick chuckle. Now, again, I'm not so out of shape with them poking fun at other Christians, but I think that on balance, we should be the punchline of our own jokes. If we are going to use sarcasm, we're going to use this kind of sort of biting humor, it is appropriate in Christian decorum to show a level of humility by making ourselves the punchline of the jokes as much as anyone else. I mean, I'm saying this with a level of self-conviction. I have and still too often cross the line with wanting to be funny at the expense of other people, and I have felt the rebuke of that. And hopefully, when my brothers faithfully correct me on that, I'm always open to being corrected. But I don't have a sense that anyone in this camp is correcting Doug Wilson on this. I don't ever hear any kind of confession or apology for crossing the line. It just seems to be continual mockery and sarcasm and all of that of just about everyone around you. And this is also another thing that concerns me. Is this tendency from groups like this to promote sort of a us, not so much an us versus them, certainly that is there, but maybe an only us mentality. Doug Wilson, again, disputes this. You know, he says he's willing to link arms and work with any kind of people, but he just doesn't get the invitations. Or if he gets the invitations, he gets uninvited. So he would say, "No, I'm always willing to work with other people, but the discourse that he uses, I think, generates an idea among some people that virtually all the rest of the Christian world is cowardly, shrinking back, unwilling to be bold." And I say that not only because I see people moving in such large numbers to Idaho, but because of the people I know who are big fans of Doug Wilson within their particular church take on this same kind of biting criticism of their local congregations. This It's not promoting Christian unity. It's not promoting the fact that we are all brothers and sisters who are fellow pilgrims marching through this world. Listen, I understand as well as anyone the need to call out unfaithfulness. I understand the need to even make distinctions and differentiations theologically between ourselves and other people. Doug Wilson challenges people who are completely aligned with him theologically and does so with the same kind of criticism. I also question Wilson's whole sort of demeanor, his public persona, commenting on the culture and saying you need to apocalypse-proof your home. He's constantly lampooning the culture and calling Christians to get ready for the coming cultural collapse. Now, I just have to confess, I don't really know how this jives with his so-called optimism. Because one of his frequent things is that those of us who have a different eschatology from him, that is to say, he's post-millennial, some of us are pre-millennial, and we are often labeled as the pessimist of the Christian world. Like we have an eschatology that is necessarily pessimist. And yet I'm not out there producing these inflammatory videos telling people that they need to be preparing themselves, you know, radically for the coming cultural collapse. At least not to the same volume that Doug Wilson's doing it. So I just note that as well. I don't really know how all of this coordinates with his so-called optimism, because I find very little in what he's saying optimistic. In fact, I find almost nothing optimistic about the culture or the world. He just is always talking about how it's in flames. This is one of his defenses, as you know, people talk about him using all these incendiary terminology and backgrounds of things on fire. You know, almost every November, the opening YouTube is something being set on fire in a big way, or him in some sort of burning house or burning boat or, you know, burning truck or whatever it is, you know, and he's sitting there throwing bombs. But he would say, well, amen, we're not actually setting things on fire. We're just acknowledging that the world is on fire and is going up in flames. It's like, what kind of post-millennialism is that? You know, what kind of optimism is that? It's not necessarily that I disagree with him. It's just I don't really know how he reconciles that with his supposed optimism. I don't find very much optimistic in it at all. That's more of a theological quibble than anything else. So this is, I think something that people need to be thinking about and thinking about deeply. I'll say another thing, too. This is also coming from Kevin DeYoung. I'll just read to you this paragraph. He says, the videos squarely focus on Wilson himself. At one level, it's not surprising. Christian institutions and organizations often use their founder, president, or leading voice as the face of their ministry. But the focus here is not on Wilson as the conduit of biblical teaching and doctrinal truth, or even as the instrument of helpful cultural analysis. The focus is on Wilson himself. Wilson as the rebel. Wilson as the gunslinger. Wilson as the taboo-breaking cigar smoker. Wilson as the courageous hero we need in a crazy world like ours. No Quarter November is selling a carefully cultivated personality and image, Wilson's personality and Wilson's image. I can't remember where he says this, but later on, I think I can find this really quick. Later on, he points out that if we saw other people doing this, particularly... I should have made a note. Yeah. He says, if Rick Warren did videos like Doug Wilson's group does, they would have very much the same vibe. The same people who love Wilson's gimmicks would almost certainly lampoon a hyped up, dressed up Rick Warren close up as self-serving cringe. And I think it's true. People give him a pass because they particularly like his theology, but if you were not inclined towards his theology and you watch it, it's hard to come away thinking, man, this is anything but self-exaltation and self-glory, which is, again, this goes back to the main issue of worldliness. It's not so much that the world hates you because of your message. It's the methodology that you're employing is mimicking the world. There's nothing about it that promotes a sort of a broken-hearted contrition at the remaining sinfulness in your own heart. In fact, I haven't watched everything, but I listened to, I don't know, an hour, maybe hour and a half of stuff over the last couple of weeks of Doug Wilson. I haven't heard a single thing that is promoting that kind of broken-hearted contrition. It's all sort of bravado, braggadocio stuff. And this is what I think is the worldly element of it. It is being overlooked because of some particularly hot-button cultural issues where Doug Wilson aligns with the rest of us. But what isn't being examined is the spirit, the overall spirit of this approach that I think is essentially worldly. And then this kind of gets into what is my final critique. There's more that is in this article and more that I could say, but I want to talk particularly about his use of liberties. Whether it is sitting on the boat drinking hard liquor, as he does in one video, or his propensity to always be puffing on a cigar as he is promoting whatever he's promoting, and in the midst of it, intentionally poking fun at those people who are struggling with his image of doing all of that, it is, on top of all that, his particular use of lewd language. Now, there's a whole section in here from Kevin DeYoung on this. He starts off, I fear that much of the appeal in Moscow is an appeal to what's worldly in us. As we've seen, the mood is often irreverent, rebellious, full of devil may care playground taunts that doesn't make us better as Christians. And the well-worn critique of the seeker-sensitive movement is apt for the Moscow mood as well. What you win them with is what you win them to. With so many of Wilson's videos and blogs, he's winning an audience with a spirit of derision, cavalier repartee, and the drinking down of liberal tears. Pugnacity and jocularity are not the occasional and unfortunate byproducts of the brand. They are the brand. And even more troubling is Wilson's deliberate decision to use uncouth and sinful language, especially language of a sexual nature. His own denomination has criticized his unnecessarily provocative language, including phrases like small-breasted biddies, lumberjack dykes. At other times, he's used, Kevin DeYoung uses a whole sort of slew of words that are asterisks for the vowels, a bunch of sexually tinged or explicitly sexual words, and never expressed any regret for any of this. Wilson defends himself in this by saying that everyone is so focused on his words but are unwilling to engage with the substance of his argument, and that these are just red herrings. These are ways to distract from their inability to respond to his arguments rather than dealing with the substance of what he's trying to say. In fact, he says that the substance of what he says is so much more important than the terminology that he uses. And in fact, some cases he would even defend the terminology as necessary to the substance. But even some of the terminology he uses has nothing to do with the world. It actually is talking about other Christians. He talks, for example, about people within the PCA, the Presbyterian Church of America, and some of the work that they're doing, he describes as a stacked blonde in tight dress. So he's just using very sexual terminology to talk about other Christian people and just the Christian work that they're doing in very provocative language. At one time he wrote about a Presbyterian group as stacked as Dolly Parton after her new implants. So it begs the question, is this kind of language, first of all, appropriate for Christians? Is it appropriate for theological discourse above that? And is it particularly appropriate for pastors? I think Kevin DeYoung asked this question: what candidate coming forward for ordination could get away with writing those kinds of things? What parent would be thrilled if their daughter's new boyfriend sprinkled his vocabulary with these kinds of words? Not me. And I know for us as elders, we wouldn't be ordaining anybody who had that kind of language. It's not becoming of a Christian. And in fact, I think it goes in direct violation of what Paul says in Ephesians chapter 5, when he says, "Be imitators of God, beloved children, and walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God." So he's talking about a kind of love here that we are to have for one another that is in some ways exemplified, or not some ways, in every way exemplified by Christ and by his sacrifice for us. And then he contrasts in verse 3 that love that he's talking about in verses 1 and 2, he contrasts in verse 3 with a different kind of love. We might say a very sensual, worldly form of love. He says, "But sexual immorality and all impurity or covetousness must not be named among you as is proper among the saints. Let there be no filthiness, nor foolish talk, nor crude joking, which are out of place, but instead let there be thanksgiving. For you may be sure of this, that everyone who is sexually immoral or impure or is covetous, that is an idolater, has no inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God." And then he says, "Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things the wrath of God comes on the sons of disobedience." So don't be partners with them. Paul's very, very clear. We are to have a love, and we're to exemplify a kind of love, we're to uphold a kind of love that is exemplified in Christ, not exemplified by the world. And to explicitly sexualize your language like this, and to explicitly promote these kinds of sexual images in the minds of your people, I think is in direct violation of what Paul is talking about here. I have to say, it unfortunately reminds me of the very sad, sad story of, what's the guy, the Seattle pastor? Mark Driscoll, yeah. Makes me, yeah, that's exactly right. So I'm a little less worried about sort of Doug Wilson maybe ending his final days exactly the way Mark Driscoll has, just simply because he has less of a runway. Less time to sort of, but I suppose you could make a lot of mistakes in just a few years. But Driscoll, it seemed, got worse and worse and worse as time went on. And I do wonder about Doug Wilson now that he has so much spotlight on him and such a voice through his media, whether or not this is going to be tamped down or whether or not it's just going to get worse and worse. These kinds of things, though, are just showmanship, which I think is unbecoming of a minister of the gospel, and the kind of very thing that Paul says that he avoided. In 2 Corinthians chapter 3, he uses this terminology. I want to maybe flip over there, see if I can find it, because I'm probably going to misquote it. Go ahead, John. Yes, that's right before that passage in Ephesians. A whole section talking about your language and your tongue.
And again, Paul in Philippians 2, 3, 4, I mean, it just keeps, do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility, consider others better than yourselves. Each of you should let know that you have its own interest for those who have its own.
Yeah, I think as ministers of the gospel and as Christians in general, when we are engaging in public discourse, we ought to be engaging at an intellectual level on the ideas, but we also ought to be demonstrating a level of humility. Not saying that you can't ever engage in sarcasm. Like we said, the Apostle Paul does that. But it's always balanced, almost immediately, with expressions of love and consideration and affection for the very people he's writing to. And if Wilson did more of that, I would probably have less concern about his sarcasm. I don't want to be sort of so straight-laced and such a killjoy myself. I mean, I enjoy joking around as much as anybody. But I think the combination of that kind of bravado and then the provocative, sexualized language that is peppered all the way through his discourse, again, getting back to Kevin DeYoung's point, is worldly. It is worldly. It's appealing to something that is worldly within us. Kevin DeYoung says, going on about these sort of sexualized language, he says, were I to use these words in public or in private, I would quickly be confronted by my elders and likely brought before my presbytery for questioning. If I persisted, I would probably be deposed as a minister, and rightly so. I can say the same thing. I mean, if I were to do that, I would be confronted by my elders. I know, because I have been. Not so much for sexualized language, but for too much sarcasm sometimes. I have had blessed brothers who have called me out on stuff like that. And doesn't seem to be anyone in Wilson's orbit who's willing to do that for him, which makes me wonder about what kind of plurality of leadership is actually there among their session. So, one more thing. Let's see what kind of time we have here. Let me just have one more comment here coming out of Kevin DeYoung's article. He says, ironically, for all of Wilson, all Wilson says and writes about manhood, he has this reputation for calling for a muscular, angular Christianity. He promotes this sort of manly, I don't know how to define that any better, but this very strong, aggressive form of Christianity. He says, for all Wilson says about manhood, his online tone is often juvenile. Petty insults and childish put-downs do not display the manly virtue of magnanimity. The loftiness of spirit that enables one to bear trouble calmly, to disdain meanness, and to display a noble generosity is not found in Wilson. And I think that is also a very, very good point. It promotes such a narrow form of manliness that in some ways is a mirror of certain segments of the culture, not others. I was thinking about this as I was talking to a young man, probably goes back 2 years ago, but first time I ever heard the name Andrew Tate. Do y'all know who that is? Who knows who Andrew Tate is? Raise your hand. Yeah, if you're under 30 or in here, you probably know who that is. I didn't know who the guy was, but this young Christian was telling me how much he appreciated Andrew Tate. And I started to look up this guy, and I thought, this is terrible. I mean, this guy, whatever he's promoting here, is sort of borders on the exploitation of other people. And sure enough, I think the guy's been arrested a couple times for trafficking women now. I don't know. He claimed to be a Christian at one point, didn't he? And now he claims to be a Muslim. Is that right? So he just kind of shifts his religion to match his worldliness. But there is something about that kind of bravado that some people mistake for manliness and even mistake for Christian. Because Christians do talk about the headship and leadership and courage and, the need to be even, I would say, providing for your family. Those kinds of things do intersect from time to time with some of those, you might say, more traditional forms of manliness. But that doesn't mean that those forms are Christian in and of themselves. In fact, they might be very unchristian. They might be very self-centered. Or another way to say that is there is a way for you to think about headship, leadership, the role of men. There's a way for you to think about that that is very self-centered. It is claiming the mantle of leadership for the sake of self-serving. Well, nothing in biblical manhood is about serving yourself. It is about sacrifice. This is the keynote in Paul's commitment to the family in Ephesians chapter 5, is that you love your wife as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. So everything we do is out of a sense of self-sacrifice and laying ourselves down. And that is not the magnanimity that is always on display with Wilson and some others who are promoting this form of manliness. This is also sort of intersects with Driscoll, right? Driscoll's view of manhood promoted this kind of self-serving notion. So I think it's not manhood, it is this juvenile behavior that we have too much of in modern culture that is sometimes being promoted by Wilson. So those are just a couple of my observations and intersections with a critique from Kevin DeYoung. And I say all this because I think that there are some people who are being brought into the Christian nationalism orbit, not because of the ideas of Christian nationalism. Some of them may have never read a book on Christian nationalism. Some of them may struggle to even articulate with explicit clarity on what exactly it is or how it works out. But they're drawn to this. And they're drawn to it because they're frustrated. They're frustrated by the onslaught at work. They're frustrated by the onslaught of culture. They're frustrated by losing what they give a sense of losing in the culture. And they want to fight back. And this appeals to their desire to fight back. But I would raise the question of, where is that desire coming from? That desire to fight back, is it the loss that you personally feel of your own comforts and luxuries in the world? Because that's no reason to fight back. The reason we fight back is the glory of God. The reason we fight back is the clarity of the gospel. The reason we fight back is so that people who don't know Christ can know Christ. It isn't because we're being taxed a little more or we're losing even a few freedoms here and there. It is really centered on the glory of God. And this is what concerns me with Christian nationalism in general and really exemplified by Doug Wilson particularly. So that's it. Anybody have any questions or comments? Pushback? Sarcasm? Jokes? Yes?
Or whether it's Alistair Begg or whether it's Russell Moore, all of
Well, I would say there are people who called out David French or Russell Moore very early on, and rightly so, but without this tone.
Yeah.
So there's a way to do it, and it needs to be done.
Yeah.
When people are, well, I think those guys in particular are taking their virtue, their clues of virtue from the world rather than from the gospel.
Yeah.
They're defining virtue based on what the world thinks rather than the gospel. And there are others that you could lump in there. So I don't have a problem. And like I said at the very beginning, it's not so much even the content of Doug Wilson. I mean, we would agree on many of the cultural things with him. It is just the tone. It is just the way in which it's done that I think is promoting disunity among believers, immaturity, and selfishness, essentially. Those would be my main concerns. Yes? Yeah, I haven't seen that explicitly, the conflagration happen explicitly. It might be more, I guess the mood is the right word here. It's kind of the mood of it that gets blended together sometimes. In the sense of just wanting to take action. That's the thing that I think probably gets at the heart of it. Frustration and the sense that we're losing the cultural battle, and we have to do something. And in some ways, we've celebrated in our nation certain heroes that have sort of given us the impression that we've got a call to arms to do something about this. But I think that is a flat reading historically, and a superficial reading of some of the lives of the people that we've celebrated. That's a whole nother conversation about how our understanding of American history might intersect with where we are in culture today. But I think there is just this mood of not wanting to give up and surrender. And so it makes you want to take action in some way. And he provides an avenue to do that that seems practical. Like you said, I think you used the word pragmatic. It seems practical. He gives me something to do rather than just pray and preach the gospel and live a faithful Christian life. There's something about this, too, that I think mirrors the old radical, if you guys remember the radical movement, the radical book, the radical movement, that gave the impression that somehow you're a second-tier Christian if you're not selling everything you have and moving to the sort of darkest, most unreached areas of the world. So that a mom who wakes up every morning and changes, you know, 8 diapers and washes the dishes, prepares a lunch for her food, as if that's not a faithful Christian. When sometimes that might be one of the most radical things you can do, is just to be that, just a normal Christian in the course of life. I think that's what this taps into sometimes, is that those of us who are just trying to live out our faith in the context of our day-to-day life are wimps. When we're just trying to be faithful witnesses to the gospel wherever we are. We're gone over time, so any questions, you'll have to catch me afterwards. So let me dismiss you guys and let you go off to your work, and then if you have questions, you feel free to come up here.